This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Join us as we talk to another leader who works with others in the community.
Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. Get ready for today's conversation as we have a special guest from the National Braver Angels organization joining us. April, who are we talking with today?
Glenn, I'm really excited. Our guest today is Monica Guzman, and she has recently been a speaker on the UA Little Rock campus. She came in for our campus read on her book entitled, I Never Thought of It That Way. The subtitle of that book is How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. And she's here to talk to us today about her work in using curiosity to build bridges across the political divide. So, Monica, welcome to On the Other Hand. We really appreciate you joining us for our podcast, and we'll start by acknowledging you're not normally here in Arkansas, but you are a leader nationally for Braver Angels, and that work, along with your best-selling book, means that you've had an impact on many in Arkansas who might even be listening that have never met you. I know I used your book last fall in a listening and civil dialogue class that I taught here at UA Little Rock, and it was very well received. So I'd love to have you just talk briefly about how you got into this bridge building work and the space what you're doing today.
Yeah, well, first off, it's a real treat. This is my first trip to Arkansas, and it's been awesome. And a very silly thing that has been delightful is just being able to say y'all and not worrying, you know, living in Seattle, that someone will be like, why is she talking like a Southerner? I'm talking like a Southerner because I'm in the South. Also, y'all is just a great word. Anyway, I'm a y'all advocate all the way. The way I got into this work professionally was primarily through journalism. In Seattle, the politics are quite blue. The polarization over there, if it exists, is between deep blue and light blue. So it's a very unique and very interesting place to be. As a journalist, you know, I consider the thing that I have to do is try to help people understand each other. And so while I was working on local journalism, I was sensing, especially after the 2016 election, some intense pressure from folks in the city to get the publication that I ran to have a political side, to take a political side. There was so much pressure to do this, and it felt increasingly difficult to create a forum through that publication that actually allowed room for a lot of different perspectives. And because there was so much pressure, I think I understood better than I had before how much I care about preserving forums for different perspectives. And I started to learn more about what that really takes, everything from language that speaks across differences, using that kind of language, and what feeling welcoming really means. And at the same time, I had two people checking in on that who were, you know, pretty open critics of a lot of stuff, and that's my parents. So I am very blue myself, and my parents are quite red. So in Braver Angels parlance, blue and red is leaning blue is Democratic and leaning red is conservative. So they both voted for Trump, and being Mexican immigrants to a lot of people in Seattle, that was very surprising. So it was always a way to spark conversation, this surprising thing about my politically divided family. And maybe what surprised some people the most is that I talk to my parents, they talk to me, we know each other's reasons. We've had really tough conversations, we continue to have them. And so all of that added up to, it almost happened on its own, where it just added up to, man, if I want to help people understand each other, just being a journalist isn't enough, because there's this brokenness at the foundation of the places we tell stories and the assumptions we have about what stories should be. And so I just found myself slowly creeping toward this bridge building space until May 2021, when the organization I'd been volunteering for, Braver Angels, hired me on the national staff.
Well, and that's how we got to know you, which is amazing. And I know you have your own accolades in the journalism world as well. But we're really here to talk about how you go about, how you've developed ability and skills in having conversations with others in a variety of ways. And so we're going to be focusing on that, but also be asking you probably some questions related to what can we do in terms of our intake of journalism, our own intake of the media to help us, as that tends to sometimes be polarizing in and of itself. So, Glenn, why don't you go ahead and I'll turn it over to you to ask a question. So,
okay, Monica, you've had quite the journey so far from what I know about you and what I've heard about you. You've clearly had a lot of practice at having conversations with folks, and in your work as a journalist, as an author, and going around the country, as well as, you know, doing that for Braver Angels nationally, it's clear that you've had lots of experiences and interactions with people. So I'm wondering, given what you're trying to teach people and what you're trying to share with others, can you share with us maybe a few of your, what I might call, greatest hits from those conversations you've had? What are maybe some two or three especially enlightening or engaging individuals or interactions that you've had? Any important ideas that we all might find helpful from your experience so far?
Recently, I had a wonderful conversation with a someone at Braver Angels who is red, so is conservative. And often at Braver Angels, you know, our conversations among each other, with each other, are about our work. So there's not, it's not like every single day we're talking about politics. But he and I did get into a couple of things that, frankly, had been sort of bothering me for a while and had been bothering him for a while, around the election and around how blues and reds talk about the 2020 election. And in particular, we got to a point in the conversation, and this was a good 40 minutes in, if not more, where I felt comfortable, you know, sharing with him sort of a vulnerability that I have felt, which is, as a journalist, I have to stand for truth, right? That's what I do. And I think it's important for all of us to do that. As a mediator and someone who believes so much in the prerequisite of establishing trust, I believe really wholeheartedly in not speaking in ways that make people feel condescended to or ruled out. And sometimes it can feel to me like those two things are in conflict. So, for example, with the election, I have heard on podcasts some journalists speak about the obviousness of like the 2020 election was totally fine, and then in the same breath say awful things about people who doubt that election, right? And so it's like those two things become tied in my mind, and I don't know sometimes how to stand for what I believe is true, which is that there, as far as I have seen, there's not enough evidence to think that the 2020 election was fraudulent. But how do I say that in a way that doesn't immediately shut out, you know, reds who have serious doubts? Like, my parents had doubts in the beginning, you know, like, this is not, I don't believe that's a dehumanizing quality. It's like, it's okay to have doubts about our political process. So I shared this with him, and he was so empathetically hearing me out. And we talked about the role of truth in this. And we talked about that tense negotiation. But I remember the insight that came out of it, because we ended up sharing our frustrations. You know, I shared my frustration with, to me, it can feel like some folks on the right, on the red side, aren't standing for truth enough against maybe forces on their own side who seem to be encouraging what I think are not great things for our democratic republic, right? And he was saying, but from our side, it's like the blue side can't see its own ways that, even though things haven't been, maybe it's, you know, a matter of degree. Okay, January 6th was pretty bad. Granted, he said, granted, right? But there's this, and there's this, and there's this, and there's these things that we don't hear blues acknowledge being in the same sort of universe, and they're just not acknowledged. So it's always like the reds are all bad, and they're the only ones doing the bad thing. Anyway, we were having this broad conversation. What he said, where I think he nailed it, is he said, He said, like, the thing is, when these conversations happen, and it's always one-sided, where, you know, it's a conversation about the election and truth and all that, but all we talk about is what Reds did wrong. All we talk about is what Reds did wrong. And we don't, there's no acknowledgement of, you know, this can come into the blue side in these ways. He said, when you are able to do that, you get to the bigger issues. You get to the deeper issues. And I realized how right he was.
So there's that tendency to kind of engage in an all or none type of thinking or speech, and probably on both sides, not to get into, you know, false equivalency, but certainly, you know, the fact, and I've seen that so much, and I've wondered about that, how much in the political dialogue nowadays, it's all about every single thing that happens, you know, the other side makes it into a totally bad thing on the part of the other side. It's all their fault. All this bad stuff happened, and not taking any responsibility for themselves. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about, right?
That's exactly right. And we talked about, it ended up going into this wonderful conversation about blame, because there's such a need, you know, when we're frustrated about politics, to have someone to blame, right? Like, this is because of the Reds, this is because of the Blues. But it's true, whatever sin, political sin we see on the other side, there is some reflection on our own side. And now after that conversation with him, I'm more fully aware that any conversation that places blame on one side without any acknowledgement of some resonance on your own is an incomplete conversation that will not be as complex and as true as it ought to be. It will not get to the deeper issues. And you know, we pushed on this because I pushed on the sort of matter of degree, meaning like, hey, January 6th was pretty bad, right? Like, can we acknowledge it? And he was like, yes, of course we can. But again, I think that in our regular political discourse, you know, the matter of degree thing we use to justify a sort of blame of the other side, where I don't have to talk about my side at all. What you did was so bad that, like, you know, yeah, that we just don't have to. But again, if you listen to the other side, they will tell you things your side did that were also pretty bad that you might have just dismissed because, well, I don't know. I mean, look at it from their perspective. That stuff was pretty bad too. But what he said was, it's not an equivalence. This isn't about making an equivalence. It's about seeing the full picture. And so it was a relief to me to hear him say that look, even though I don't accept, you know, that the matter of degree means that you can just blame Reds and that's it in the conversation, that doesn't work. I'm also not saying that there's an equivalence, that we have to pretend that we're all doing the same thing. It's like, no, sometimes one side does something that's worse. That's fine. But we can't get to the truth unless we're talking about America as a whole, all sides in one, all sides being accountable and responsible for the health of our society.
That's interesting because you said this didn't happen or start coming out until y'all talked about 40 minutes. And knowing you, you're already practicing these skills. So perhaps there's a lesson there for us that when we're having these conversations, we have to be a little bit patient and not expect things to turn around right away when we're using these skills that you and Braver Angels talk about.
Absolutely. And as April knows, and as you know, Glenn, at Braver Angels, we have structures. And in our workshops, which are structured, these kinds of topics can come out fairly quickly. But that's because there's an artificial structure put into everything that makes folks feel secure, right, and bought in. But this conversation that I'm talking about was very organic. And so with organic conversations, you have to feel your way through. And it's hard to predict, right? You don't know exactly when's the right moment to say this or that. The other thing, you have to feel your way through. And that takes practice.
Yeah, so one of the things that I think about as you're talking about this is the concept of intellectual humility. I almost was sensing that as we're acknowledging, here's what my side, the role of my side, and the other side, and the other person, here's the role of what my side is as well, so that we can both kind of acknowledge we're not perfect, rather than pointing the finger at the other side of where you're not perfect. That always tends to, in relationships in general, tends to go off better when we're acknowledging this is my role in this or my group's role in this, as opposed to you are like this.
It's a way to make sure that we're talking about the whole, even when we're zooming into the one slice where the heat is. keep the whole in mind, because that makes everyone remember that we're ultimately on the same team here. We are marching in the same direction, and the relationship that binds us together is important. And so, yeah, it's exactly as you say. It's like you can't walk up to someone in your life and like, you know, just like that. If there's something that you did too, begin with that humility and that acknowledgement, and then you can communicate.
So one of the things I wonder about for authors like yourself is how much of what you wrote is aspirational for yourself and how much of it is something that you practice on an everyday occurrence. As a communication professor, I often think about that in my own classes, where I'm teaching things that sometimes I don't practice. I would love to say I practice it all the time. And I'm curious about how the writing of this book and the experiences that you've had as you've been talking to other groups of people have contributed to your own growth as a communicator, as a person that's a bridge builder.
Yeah. Part of what's tricky and difficult to put into a book, there's a tension, there was a tension for me, and there still is, a tension between people want prescriptions, they want the scripts, they want the tools. There's a tension between that, the need for the tools and the tactics, and the degree to which I believe that this is organic, unpredictable work that flows in the moment, that when you are present with someone else in conversation, that comes first. And so there's so much you can't script, right? And so that tension animated a lot of the research for the book, and it still courses through my head. I mean, you were at the event that I just did and the University of Arkansas, and people were talking about, how do I know when to just stop a conversation? Or where's a red line? So again, we look for, give me the one rule that applies to everybody, and it just doesn't exist. So with that framework for myself, there are relationships where the tools come way to the forefront because there's not as much familiarity. I don't know the other person all that well, and so I'm really leaning into that. Or it's a more professional type of relationship, so I'm really leaning into that. But with my more intimate personal relationships, I don't think of the tools. I already know the people, and there's practice there, and there's well-worn paths. And I suppose I trust that my intuition has been learning without my knowledge. And I think to a large part that's been true. So many of my conversations have been about this work. So many of my conversations have been doing this work that, I mean, it's kind of awesome, right? Like, our hearts and minds tend to learn without our trying. And so I can feel that intuition sort of grow. And the last thing I'll say is that since I wrote the book, which is, you know, many, many words, like 80,000 words, I have written at least that many just from journaling and taking notes and trying to think through all the travel that I've done and all the people who I've met who have asked all questions, like the questions you're asking me now. And I'm always just churning and churning and churning and, you know, trying to ask myself, like, wait, do I have this wrong? Maybe I need to try it this different way. So there are no final answers here. I mean, in large part, the book was about embracing uncertainty so that you can be curious. And I'm trying to, that's maybe the biggest lesson of all, and I'm trying to walk that talk.
For a person who hasn't read the book, can you summarize that point, that embracing uncertainty in order to be curious, or being curious to embrace uncertainty? I don't know which one comes first.
Yeah. I mean, it's chicken and egg, really. So the title of the book is, I never thought of it that way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. So the central thesis is, we're so divided, we're blinded. And I like the way Braver Angels co-founder Bill Doherty said this recently, we're so polarized, we're paralyzed. We're blinded to who each other really is. We're blinded to what our debates are truly about. And we are judging each other more as we engage each other less, which makes no sense for any kind of eventual resolution. We're getting more, you know, further and further apart. So what I have found is a really promising way back is curiosity. And curiosity is a practice. Everyone is capable of it. And the book spends most of the time talking about how we become curious. The archvillain of curiosity is certainty. When you think you know, you won't think to ask. In dangerously divided times, people manufacture certainty. We have sociological research about this. When we're tense and we're anxious, we'll grab the first answer to a tough question that comes along because at least it soothes us and we can move on and we can breathe again. So we're plagued by certainty, certainty about those other people and the horrible things they think, right? And that certainty is the root, I think, of a lot of our trouble. And the solution is curiosity and intellectual humility and leaving the door open in your mind. And that takes courage. So I talk about curiosity being the real resistance, right? There's a lot of glory in being like, I'm going to resist this or that political thing. It's like, you know, honestly, the deepest, toughest thing to resist is the tribalism, is the certainty, is the judgment that is reckless. That's the real big move here. So that's what the book is ultimately about, is we have to live in that uncertainty and be okay with it and welcome the nuance and welcome the, not just the possibility, but yeah, the certainty that we're wrong about something. We just don't know what. So we have to lean on our fellow citizens and allow them to surprise us.
Okay. Let me get into this. You mentioned something about some of the research you're familiar with. I've done a lot of looking at that. I'm a recently retired psychologist and did a lot of work to look at what the research says in the social sciences about polarization and attitude change. And it was pretty enlightening, as you know, from getting into it. It's pretty complicated. With all this incivility and overt hostility, even at times, a lot of people may not realize how much they're playing out roles that are kind of strongly influenced by some of the things that we found through research. I wonder, in your own looking into this kind of things, what do you think produces such friction between people and groups who differ politically? What you mentioned one. Do you have any other insights for our listeners about what causes that difficulty?
I mean, another villain of curiosity is fear. So most of it really comes down to fear. Fear is based on the level of threat we believe each other represents. And the key word there is believe. So again, we have certainty and we hear these narratives. They're denying our humanity. They're destroying America. And then we believe it. What? We believe it without getting close and checking it out person by person because, well, gosh, if those people are out to destroy America, if they're out to kill liberty, if they're denying my human existence, then it will only harm me and the world for me to engage with them. It will only release the demons that they hold within, right? So it's this seeing each other as true threats and monsters that gets in our way. And I don't want to diminish the very high stakes in our issues. And that's really where it begins. It begins in a very, very valid place, which is that we are talking about some pretty big things right now that really, really are at the heart of people's identities. And that's happening more and more, which is not making any of this easier. So it does feel very personal. It's not, we're disagreeing about something, and this is an intellectual exercise. It's, you are rejecting me. It's if we go where you want us to go, I'm not allowed in, and I can't accept that. I'm not given the freedom I think I need to live out my values or live out my life. I mean, it's hard to imagine any higher stakes than that. So, but I'll say again, it's the belief in that. It may not be true. And the research is showing us that we are making rampant exaggerations when we guess at the views of the other side. So even though, yes, there are some people who harbor, are consumed by hate and are worth fearing, there are not as many as we think, not even close. Not even close. And then to go deeper is, when people are consumed by hate, I don't believe that they're irredeemable. I don't. I think that being consumed by hate is something that can be unpacked. It's often something that comes from a deep fear of loss, you know, yourself, and a deep sense of threat yourself. And the more that people who are consumed by hate are left to just wallow in it, the worse all this gets. So yeah, there's a lot there.
Monica, thanks so much for joining us on our podcast today. Now, we do have a lot more that we'd like to explore with you. So if you'll be so kind, we'll just continue this conversation later.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of On the Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed the first part of today's discussion with Monica Guzman. Be sure to check out the second part of our conversation with her, as well as our other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand, on the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braveranges.org/podcast or on your favorite podcast site.
When you visit our website, you can help us improve our program by responding to a brief survey, for which you'll find a link on our webpage. You can also email us for program or speaker ideas or other feedback at otherhandar@gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band. Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter,
have a good evening, and let's all work to bring our community closer together.